Good day. Today is Tuesday, 17th February 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel if, once you've watched this programme, or whichever part of this programme you wish to watch, you decide that you like what you have heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now today I'm going to start this programme with the performance, the theatre, if you prefer, of the negotiations that are taking place today in Geneva. I say performance and theatre because it's difficult at the present time for me to take these negotiations especially seriously. Consider, first of all, the fact that two sets of negotiations are taking place in Geneva and that some of the participants in these negotiations are involved in both of them. Specifically, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, to the American representatives, the President of the United States Peace Envoy, in the case of Steve Witkoff, the President's son-in-law, in the case of Jared Kushner, though no one has ever explained what actual official position in the government of the United States Jared Kushner actually occupies. Anyway, these two individuals are simultaneously involved in both negotiations. According to Reuters, they will be attending a meeting with the Ukrainians and the Russians in the morning, and then in the afternoon they will be going to the next other negotiation, which will be with the Iranians. Or it may be that I've got it the wrong way round and it's the Russians and the Ukrainians in the afternoon and the Iranians in the morning. It really doesn't matter, because it seems to me that to conduct negotiations in this way, two sets of highly important negotiations in this way, is simply not serious. And in the case of Witkoff, I understand that along with the plenary meetings that are taking place between the Russians, the Ukrainians and the Americans, which he will presumably also be attending, he's also going to have a separate meeting of another working party in which he heads the American delegation. And that working party is discussing issues of economic cooperation between Russia and the United States, including, as I understand it, in terms of any future reconstruction of Ukraine. And the opposite number, his opposite number in this negotiation is going to be Kirill Dmitriev, who, by the way, I also understand will not be attending the main plenary meeting between the Russians, the Ukrainians and the Americans. If this is correct, well, it becomes obvious that Witkoff is an extraordinarily overworked man. Even if he was Napoleon Bonaparte or Hercules, I can't see how he would be able to manage all of these incredibly complicated negotiations conducted at this extraordinarily high level, basically all at one and the same time, even if he was to be going from one meeting to the next over the course of the day. Anyway, let's not perhaps spend too much time on this. I am going to suggest that there is indeed an mystery, or a set of mysteries, about this meeting in Geneva. Now, on the eve of the meeting in Geneva, the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, who, as I've said many times, comes across as the hard man in the Russian Foreign Ministry. Anyway, he gave a lengthy interview to the Russian media in which he spoke about this negotiation in detail. He said that the Russians would come to the negotiations in Geneva, insisting on the full implementation of what they agreed with the Americans, with Donald Trump and Steve Witkoff, at the summit meeting between Putin and Trump, which took place in Alaska in August. The Russians talk about the Anchorage formula, the Anchorage understanding. Sometimes they talk about the spirit of Anchorage. And the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, over the course of recent interviews, has said that prior to the meeting in Anchorage, Steve Witkoff came to Moscow with a document setting out some sort of American proposal. This document was presented to Putin. Putin worked through the proposal with Witkoff in Moscow. Putin said that the Russians do have some concerns about aspects of the proposal from the Americans set out in the document, but that they were prepared to work with it and that they were prepared to show flexibility and to make the necessary concessions. And the Russians have said that it was this document, this American-produced document, setting out these various ideas that Putin took with him to Anchorage, and which he told Witkoff and Trump face-to-face in Anchorage that he was in agreement with. Now, the great problem, again, is that the Russians continuously give the impression that they made some sort of concessions based on this agreement. They have never told us what those concessions are. And in all of their public statements, on the contrary, they go out of their way to reiterate that their various demands, the demands that Putin set out in his speech to the Russian Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June 2024, remain unchanged. These are that Ukraine must accept complete neutral status. It cannot join NATO. It must not join NATO under any circumstances. That the Ukrainians must withdraw from all of the four regions, which must be transferred to Russia. In one of his recent interviews, Lavrov said that it was Russia's duty to return all of the territory of the four regions to the Russian homeland. So the Russians continue to insist that the entirety of the four regions must be transferred to them, that there must be demilitarization by Ukraine, in other words, that the Ukrainian armed forces must be massively reduced in scale, that there must be denuclearization, there must be, in other words, all of the demands that Putin first made when he ordered the special military operation back in February 2022, plus the four regions, the transfer of the four regions to Russia, all of that, all of those must be fully satisfied. And the Russians have actually gone even further than this. They say that not only must the four regions and Crimea be transferred in their entirety to Russia, but that transfer must receive international recognition. In other words, Ukraine, the United States, and other countries must recognize legally the four regions as sovereign Russian territory. So these are the same demands that the Russians have always made, which then begs the question of what was the compromise, what was the concession that the Russians made in Anchorage. It is completely unclear. There have been rumours that the Russians have insisted on a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass, but have said that they would be prepared to cease fire on the existing conflict lines. No Russian official, however, has ever confirmed this. And astonishingly, there's been no really reliable leak from any American official who has confirmed this either. Certainly Trump, Witkoff, and other American officials have never said publicly that the Russians ever made this kind of concession. In fact, the only agreement in Anchorage that the Americans confirm that was reached with the Russians was Trump's agreement in Anchorage that there would be no interim ceasefire, that the fighting would only end when there had been a final agreement fully agreed and signed. That, by the way, was a major concession on the American side and a huge retreat from the previous American position, which was to insist on a ceasefire first and negotiations later. Within days, Trump walked it back, but about 2 months ago, after a further telephone with Putin, he returned and confirmed it all over again. But so far, that is the only proposal, any only agreement from Anchorage that the Americans have ever confirmed. Neither side, neither the Americans nor the Russians, have of course produced the document that Witkoff brought with him to Moscow, which would presumably provide all the answers. And we have had no leaks from the US side about this document, which, given the kind of place Washington is, I find extremely surprising, and no leaks providing us with any idea of the contents of this document. Anyway, coming back to Ryabkov, he reiterated the constant theme the Russians make. It must be an agreement based on the American proposals in Anchorage, which, according to Ryabkov, address the root causes of the conflict. Ryabkov reiterated that line repeatedly, and that root causes point, of course, is well established. Neutral status for Ukraine, no entry into NATO, demilitarization, denuclearization, all of those things. That's part of the package. And the Russians say that the Americans basically agreed to it in Anchorage. It was there in the agreement that Witkoff brought with him to Moscow. So there it is. Again, to repeat once again, I struggle to understand what this concession that the Russians claim to have made actually is. At the moment, it is invisible. There were some rumours, in fact, there have been many rumours over the last few months that the Russians were prepared to show flexibility about who would control and who would own the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. There were suggestions that, well, if there wasn't suggested, it was confirmed that the United States wanted to take the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant under its own control. A proposal, by the way, which Zelensky vehemently rejected, just saying. But it was suggested that the Russians were okay with that, except that about a week ago, the Russians, including Rosatom, the Russian nuclear energy company, monopoly in fact, which now controls the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, said categorically that this is not true, that the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant is on sovereign Russian territory in Zaporozhye region, which the Russians consider to be part of their territory, and that it is not up for negotiation. It is from this, ever since it was captured by the Russians in 2022, it is a Russian nuclear power station, and the Russians have no intention or willingness to bargain it away. That, by the way, emphatic statement from Rosatom, and by the way, which was apparently backed by other Russian officials, well, that statement has attracted minimal notice in the West. So anyway, we have this mystery about the concession that the Russians are supposed to have made in Anchorage. I'm going to guess, it's the only guess I can make, that it was a concession relating to sequencing, that it accepted that the Ukrainians would withdraw from Donbass first, and that there would be a ceasefire to enable the Ukrainians to withdraw from Donbass, and after the Ukrainians withdrew from Donbass, then the question of Zaporozhye and Kherson regions would come up, though I don't believe, based on what I know now, that the Russians ever agreed to cease fire there. So anyway, that's one mystery. The other mystery is the question of the security guarantee that the United States has obviously negotiated with Ukraine and with the Europeans. Now, throughout the first half of 2025, the United States, President Trump, seemed extremely unwilling to give Ukraine any security guarantee at all. Zelensky came to Washington in February 2025. He was supposed to come to sign the Mineral Rights Agreement deal. He was absolutely furious when he learned that the Americans were not going to provide him with a security guarantee as part of that deal. And that led to the quarrel, the public row in the Oval Office. And Zelensky made repeated attempts thereafter, and the Europeans made repeated attempts thereafter to get Trump and the US officials to agree to give Ukraine some kind of security guarantee. But it was striking that Trump and the Americans never publicly did. And then Anchorage came along, and suddenly the Americans appeared to change their stance, and they started to say that yes, they were prepared to think about giving Ukraine a security guarantee after all. A security guarantee that would be similar to the Article 5 guarantee, the security guarantee under Article 5 in the Washington Treaty, which of course is the treaty that has created NATO. Now recently, the government of Finland has expressed serious reservations about this. They've told the Americans that they don't think that any security guarantee the United States gives to Ukraine should be that strong. It should not make commitments similar to Article 5, because if the Russians were to attack Ukraine, and if the United States did not come to Ukraine's assistance, then that would call the whole existence of NATO into question, because there would at that point be serious doubts about whether the United States were prepared to honour security guarantees of that kind. There's been no word of what the American reaction to that has been, but I found the fact that the Finns were making that point to the Americans extremely suggestive, and it suggests to me that the Finns don't really believe that the United States seriously intends to honour any security guarantee that it gives to Ukraine. But nonetheless, there's been lots of talk that a security guarantee of some kind between the United States and Ukraine has been negotiated. Supposedly, it involves the deployment of European forces in Western Ukraine. Supposedly, it provides for the United States to come to Ukraine's rescue in some form. An article appeared about 2 weeks ago in the Financial Times, which set out the sequencing before the United States became directly involved. I would say that that leak clearly came from Ukrainian sources, and both the Russians and the Americans were extremely unhappy about it. Anyway, we've had all of these rumours about a security guarantee of some kind being prepared between, as between the United States and Ukraine. The Russians say they know nothing about this, that the United States has never informed them about any of this, that the United States has never shown them any document outlining a security guarantee in that form. And the Russians further say that they strongly oppose a security guarantee in those terms. Now, given that the Russians say, and the Americans have agreed, that there cannot be an end to the conflict in Ukraine until all parts of the agreement, the entire peace agreement covering all issues, has been agreed, and that includes any question of security guarantees, then, frankly, this document that the Americans are apparently keeping to themselves and not sharing with the Russians is mere existence, it seems to me, puts in question the entire negotiation, the entire negotiation process, which is taking place in Geneva and in other places, and between the Americans and the Russians as well. So there is enormous amount of intrigue and mystery here. And again, to repeat, it seems to me that the reason that this has happened is because these negotiations have been conducted already in this incredibly chaotic way. The Americans talking to the Russians and pretending that they're mediators, which of course they are not. The Americans talking to the Ukrainians, again pretending that they're mediators, which of course they are not. Nobody has been in the same room at the same time so that everybody knows exactly what everybody else is saying to everyone. But now, finally, properly, in Geneva, that is what we have. We have for the first time an actual meeting in which the Russians can ask about these mysterious security guarantees and where there can be an honest and public and straightforward discussion about this anchorage formula that the Russians are talking about, which the Ukrainians do seem to know quite a lot about and about which they are extremely unhappy. Now, back in 1968, during the Vietnam War, the US President Lyndon Johnson, facing massive protests and following North Vietnam's Tet Offensive, agreed to open peace talks with North Vietnam in Paris. And peace talks did eventually start. And it is fair to say that the first months of those peace talks were indeed extremely chaotic. It took a very, very long time to sort out even simple questions like who was to sit where at the various tables and what the form of that table would be. But then eventually the negotiations did get going and they did eventually result in agreements. But those agreements took roughly 4 years to negotiate and 5 years to finalise. We are not in a conflict which can continue for 5 years. So maybe we've got some of the negotiators together for the first time in Geneva. But the clock, the time for a substantive negotiation in which all of these moving parts can be brought together, that clock is now very rapidly dialing down. And of course, there is the further factor that two of the parties to the talks, the Ukrainians who are there and the Europeans who sulkily are not, are or give every impression of being hostile to any negotiated outcome at all. Zelensky himself continues to insist that he's not prepared to withdraw from a millimetre of ground. He's not prepared to withdraw from Donbass. He insists that the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant must be handed over to him. He wants security guarantees to be signed between Ukraine and the United States right away. He complains bitterly that the document setting out the security guarantees is there, complete and ready for signature, and is very angry that the Americans are not signing it. He continues to talk about the Russians being aggressors, being people who cannot be trusted. He gives every intention of wanting to continue the war, and he and his officials continue to demand more and more weapons, more and more money to be sent to Ukraine from the West, from the United States. Well, that has basically ended now, but mostly from Europe. And he demands that the Europeans especially continue to fund Ukraine and to fund him and to fund and arm Ukraine and enable Ukraine to continue the war which, of course, Ukraine is losing. And the Europeans, predominantly, who are also not there, they oppose any negotiation at all. I say that President Macron of France and Prime Minister Meloni of Italy, back in December, said that the time had come to start some kind of dialogue with the Russians. But the Europeans have not got past first base. They've not appointed or chosen a negotiator to represent them. They cannot agree on such a negotiator. Kaya Kallas continues to make extraordinary statements about Russia, about how Russia is this eternal predator that is going to advance right across Europe, seek to take over every country in Europe, that has attacked 19 European countries without pretext or cause over the last 100 years. As I said, I find her grasp of history completely bizarre, by the way, and that no sort of negotiation with the Russians is really acceptable. And in fact, it is the Russians who must accept European conditions. It is the Russians who must cut down the size of their army. It is the Russians who must pay Ukraine compensation, reparations, in fact. It's not for the Russians to insist on any concessions from Ukraine at all. So that is Kaya Kallas's position. And she is matched in this vehemence by other European leaders. I was reading a fascinating article from a Danish public figure setting out the rhetoric of the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, the same person who one might imagine is more concerned about American demands for Greenland, which look as if they're going to resume before long. Greenland, of course, being sovereign Danish territory and might be more worried about that. But no, her rhetoric about Russia seemed to me to be every bit as intransigent, as ferocious, as deranged, in fact, as that of Kaya Kallas. So no sign of negotiations from there. And if we're talking about the leaders of the three big European countries, Meloni can't stand Macron, and Macron and Merz now seem to have quarrelled. Merz is very, very upset, apparently. He holds a big grudge against Macron because Macron torpedoed Merz's proposal back in December to float a massive loan to fund Ukraine, secured against the Russian assets held in Euroclear. And Merz is not forgiving Macron for this. There was a ludicrous film in which you saw all of these European leaders together at one meeting, and Macron was trying to talk to Merz, who was conspicuously ignoring him. I mean, it was ridiculous. It was nonsensical, and it tells you everything about the leaders of Europe at the present time. Anyway, these leaders, inadequate, incompetent, as they all are, nonetheless oppose peace in Ukraine. And of course, in the past, they've been very upset that they have no representatives at the negotiating table. But how can they seriously complain about that anymore when they haven't even been able to agree between each other about having a dialogue with the Russians at all, or who, if they were to have such a dialogue, their chief negotiator should be? So anyway, this sets the scene for the meeting in Geneva. And earlier today, I saw an article, I believe it was in the New York Times, which confirmed that which I said in my program yesterday, that the Ukrainians have been very, very alarmed by the return of Medinsky to the negotiations. So far from the general narrative that one sometimes hears, that Medinsky is a weak negotiator, the Ukrainians find him an exceptionally tough and hardline one. They dislike intensely his speeches, and they will not be happy that alongside him is Mikhail Galuzin, the Russian deputy foreign minister, who is now saying that the way forward is for Ukraine to be brought under Russian trusteeship, or rather under external trusteeship, maybe by the United Nations, maybe by someone else. And of course, the unspoken possibility is that that someone else might eventually be Russia. Just saying. So the Ukrainians are not going to be happy by all of that, and they're not going to be happy that the Russians have now made it clear that, as far as they're concerned, the negotiations in Geneva are a follow-up of the Istanbul talks in the summer, which on the Russian side were headed by Medinsky. And they will not be happy, as they're not happy, they were not happy then, that the Istanbul talks of the summer were treated by the Russians as a follow-up of the talks, also headed by Medinsky, that took place in Istanbul and Belarus in the spring of 2022. The Ukrainians have twice sought to walk away from those talks. So what does this all mean? Well, the media in the West are all saying that no one seriously expects any kind of breakthrough at the meeting in Geneva today. And frankly, I cannot see how a breakthrough is possible. The gulf is huge and unbridgeable. What I suspect the meeting will be is very uncomfortable for the Ukrainians, and perhaps to some extent for the Americans as well, with the Russians pressing questions about the security guarantee that the Americans have been talking about with the Ukrainians, and demanding again to be shown the document which supposedly exists and which Zelensky says is ready to be signed. Probably the Russians will bring up all sorts of things if we're talking about the status of the Orthodox Church, the rights of Russians, the history of Russia in Ukraine, the role of Novorossiya, the role of Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, and all of those things, the historical questions, in other words, which the Ukrainians and their Western backers hate discussing, but which form an essential part of this conflict. Well, there is no one better to discuss them than Medinsky, who was, of course, born in Ukraine and who has all the facts and all the knowledge at his fingertips, even though one can always, of course, take issue with some of his opinions and interpretations. So it's going to be an uncomfortable meeting, and I would not be surprised if the Ukrainians return to Kiev from this meeting in a towering rage, or some of them do. Anyway, there it is. That is what we're seeing. Peskov, Putin's spokesman, has said that the Russians are there to discuss everything. He said, according to Reuters, that obviously that everything includes territories, but he also said, including all of those other things that matter for us: NATO membership, neutral status, demilitarization, denuclearization, all of those things. And Peskov also said that we should not expect a statement about the results of this meeting today. And in fact, I understood from what he said that the Russians don't expect there to be any final statement after the meeting at all, which suggests also that they don't expect any significant or positive outcome from it. Which then, of course, brings us back to the question of why are the Russians agreeing to this meeting at all? And the answer to that was provided in that lengthy interview that he gave by the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov. Ryabkov said that it did not make sense for Russia to stay away from discussions or from meetings. There is nothing for Russia to hide or to be embarrassed about. If others want to talk, then Russia's position always has been that they will talk. But people should not make the mistake of thinking that that is going to lead to any substantive Russian retreats from their red lines, because that simply isn't going to be what will happen. Anyway, that was what Ryabkov said. It is a simple an explanation of why the Russians participate in these talks, as we're likely to see. And it is certainly the case that Russian diplomatic practice, certainly since the end of the Cold War, has been to participate in talks and discussions and negotiations when the option, the opportunity for those talks ever arises, and never to reject them. Anyway, there it is. Now, another Russian official, a very important Russian official, has been speaking, and there's been a great deal of interest and speculation about what the Russian military would want to see as the outcome of the conflict in Ukraine. And the comment that this Russian official made is especially interesting because he is a member of the Russian military. Now, his name is Andrei Kartopolov. He is, in fact, a colonel general in the Russian army. He served in the Russian military up to 2021. He commanded Russian forces in Syria during the Russian intervention there. He headed the political department of the Russian general staff. He is a close friend and ally, political ally, of the chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov, who is, of course, the overall commander of Russian forces in Ukraine. And, well, Kartopolov has a long and very, very interesting and storied history as a senior military officer. He resigned from the military in 2021 and was elected to the Duma, where he is now an MP. And he, in the Duma, chairs Russia's, the Duma's Defense Committee. So he is someone who, by definition, has close connections with the military. He is himself a military officer. He is, in fact, the senior military officer, or so I understand it, in the Duma. Not just a military officer, a very, very high-ranking military officer. And he is Gerasimov's friend. And, well, he gave us an understanding of what he thinks the outcome of the war should be, or of how it should work. And I'm going to read here the report about what he said from TASS, and Kartopolov's comment, by the way, was the lead story in TASS, and of course TASS is Russia's official news agency. And this is what TASS says: Ukraine will only be able to win this conflict if it becomes a part of Russia, said Andrei Kartopolov, chairman of the Defense Committee of the State Duma. Kartopolov was commenting on remarks by Finnish President Alexander Stubb, expressing belief in Ukraine's victory in its confrontation with Russia. Ukraine will only win if it becomes a part of the Russian Federation. And then TASS says that Kartopolov added that European politicians had already realized their defeat and were making such statements as the one that Stubb has made to justify themselves before their citizens. They have to tell something to their taxpayers, whose money they took and handed over to Zelensky's gang, which put it in their own pockets. That is why they will keep saying that Ukraine will win. Anyway, put that aside, Kartopolov, the first senior Russian politician that I am aware of who has spoken about the outright annexation of Ukraine by Russia. And note again that he is a military officer, a colonel general in the Russian army, a friend of Gerasimov's. I am not saying necessarily that he coordinated what he said with Gerasimov. Perhaps he didn't. But I strongly suspect that what he is saying reflects what many senior Russian officers, perhaps Gerasimov himself, privately believe, and which, for all I know, they may be communicating to the supreme commander of the Russian armed forces, who is, of course, Vladimir Putin. Just saying. I mentioned in a recent program that one of the reasons why Medvedev, the former Russian president and prime minister, who is now vice chair of Russia's Security Council and de facto head of Russia's Military Industrial Commission, appears to be taking such an extremely hard line, belligerent line, in fact, in his various comments and posts, is that as head of the Military Industrial Commission, he is in constant and regular contact with the senior officers of the Russian military. Well, we've had with Kartopolov another insight into what Russian officers perhaps think and what they're saying to each other. Now, before I finish with Kartopolov, there is something else I wanted to say, and that is that I understand, this has not been reported publicly, but I am sure that this is true. I understand that there is another report circulating in Moscow, which has been prepared by Russia's intelligence agencies and its law enforcement agencies. And this has been reported to top figures in the various Russian Duma committees. And one of the people that this report has been sent to is none other than Kartopolov himself. And this report apparently accuses senior officials, very senior officials, of the Armenian and Azerbaijanian government of being involved in various criminal activities on the territory of Russia, including the illegal drugs trade. And well, I don't want to discuss the contents of this report in any special detail, but one of those officials from Azerbaijan, in fact, was a very, very senior official indeed. And apparently, there are steps being taken to open indictments against these people. And it's been suggested that some of these Russian troop deployments to the Caucasus, specifically, that we have been hearing about over the last few weeks might be connected with these indictments as well. I am going to suggest that they may also be connected with the crisis over Iran. It could be that if there is a prolonged conflict between the United States and Iran, the Russians, if they feel that Armenia and Azerbaijan are playing any role in assisting the Americans in that conflict, they now have the grounds to intervene in Armenia and Azerbaijan, intervene by force, and that will be a very, very dramatic and extraordinary crisis indeed. Now, I am not going to explore this further in this program. This report most definitely does exist, but it seems to me that it probably forms a part of the Iran crisis, which I don't intend to discuss in this program. So I will return to it in a later program. Meanwhile, the war itself, the war in Ukraine, goes on, and it goes on with further escalations. Now, Ukrainians recently have been claiming that they've conducted counterattacks in Zaporozhye region. General Sirski, the Ukrainian overall Ukrainian commander, has now turned up in Zaporozhye region. He inspected the troops. He conducted inspections of troops in eastern Zaporozhye region, where the main weight of the Ukrainian counterattacks have been. As he tends to do, he said that everything is going well and everything is under control. He said that, I remember, even as the situation in Kursk was collapsing, even as Pokrovsk and Mirnograd were falling, he spoke about the success of the Ukrainian counterattacks north of Pokrovsk, which turned out to be wrong. And now he's talking again about the success of the Ukrainian counterattacks in Zaporozhye region. I should say that I mentioned in a recent program that the Ukrainians had sacked, or Syrsky had sacked, the commander of the assault forces, who apparently formed the spearhead of the attack in eastern Zaporozhye, General Makhno. And I saw a report in Radovka, which did indeed seem to confirm that Manko has indeed been sacked, and which republished a ferocious critique of Manko written by a Ukrainian journalist or blogger. Anyway, let's not dwell on this. The reality, as far as I can tell, is that the Ukrainian counterattack in Zaporozhye has run into the sand. It has lost momentum. In eastern Ukraine, in eastern Zaporozhye, in fact, it seems that the Russians are back on the attack again, pushing steadily towards Orekhov, which they are also attacking from the south. In fact, there are reports that there is actually fighting going on inside Orekhov itself. There's been some reports of Ukrainian sabotage and reconnaissance groups conducting some kind of raid in western Zaporozhye. That's entirely possible. I'm not going to devote time to it. It'll be another of the many ephemeral events that of that kind that take place. And I don't think there's any point in discussing it further. I said in my program, one of my recent programs, that however it looks as if the Russians have now broken into Konstantinovka from the southwest and appear close to reaching the center of Konstantinovka. And it looks as if these reports, in fact, there's been further confirmation of these reports, in which case we are probably at the turning point, if I can call it that, of the battle for Konstantinovka. It looks as if the Ukrainian resistance there is starting to fall apart or break down. Probably there are some weeks of heavy fighting still to take place, but it doesn't seem to me as if the outcome now is in any great doubt or will be prolonged much further. And the Russians have also claimed that they're continuing big advances towards Slavyansk. They captured another place called Minkova, apparently in that area between Slavyansk, Kramatorsk and Siversk, which the Russians recently captured. The word actually is that the Russians, for the moment at least, seem to be more interested in advancing towards Kramatorsk, the bigger of the two fortified cities to the south of Slavyansk, the central city in the Ukrainian defence line, the linchpin city, the keystone of the arch, if you like, of the Ukrainian defence lines, and that this is actually the area of the higher priority. Well, I'm not going to speculate about that. But there's also been a really grim and rather terrible report provided by the Russian Defence Ministry about the condition of the Ukrainian troops in the Kupiansk area, the remaining Ukrainian troops in the Kupiansk area, who are trapped, still trapped, on the east bank of the Oskol River. And this report tells us where they are. They're located to the south of the village of Kupiansk Uzlovoy, which the Russians captured about 10 days ago. And they are basically out in the open. They are in trenches which regularly get waterlogged. According to the Russian Defense Ministry, a third of them suffer from frostbite. Retreat from their positions is impossible. And these Ukrainian troops have been essentially abandoned by their command. Some of them, unsurprisingly, surrender to the Russians. But again, it tells you something about the morale, or rather the commitment of some of the Ukrainian troops, that the remainder continue to hold their ground nonetheless. Anyway, it is a horrible account of the condition of these soldiers. And I wonder for how much longer it can continue. Meantime, both Ukraine and Russia conducted strikes against each other's territories. The Ukrainians conducted strikes with drones on positions in western Russia. I've discussed them many times. The Ukrainians do send hundreds of drones into western Russia. Some of these drones do damage. The damage they do is minimal. The Russian strikes using missiles and drones, Garand drones, are far more powerful. Now, the Russian strike last night seems to have been focused again mainly on targets in the energy system and in the main cities, in Odessa, in Dnipro, in Kharkiv, I believe. In Kryvyi Rog, the Russians seem to have attacked energy complexes. And most of the missiles used were KH-101 subsonic cruise missiles launched by Russian strategic bombers. But some of the targets in eastern Ukraine were attacked by Iskander missiles. And one of the attacks with an Iskander missile took place against another electricity substation. And it is said that this particular Iskander missile carried a cluster warhead, which meant that when it struck the substation, it did massive damage to the entire facility, which was essentially destroyed. Now, there were also Russian cruise and drone attacks on western Ukraine, especially specifically on two energy facilities in western Ukraine. And though we have no information about damage to these facilities, though that is not to say that there was no damage to these facilities, we have now had a very, very revealing exposure about the realities of who is actually operating the F-16 fighter jets that have been deployed in Ukraine. And this report, or these reports, I should say, there have been several of them, have been circulating in the Western media, and they confirm that some of these F-16s, most of them, in fact, are flown by veteran, retired American and Dutch fighter pilots. I say retired, but perhaps it's worth pointing out that sometimes people are told to retire so that they can then convert themselves, if you like, into volunteers who are no longer connected to the military, directly connected to the military of their country. Anyway, just saying. Anyway, Americans and Dutch pilots are apparently flying these F-16s. And the F-16s are used, or appear to be used, for one exclusive purpose, which is to shoot down Russian drones and to shoot down Russian missiles, cruise missiles. And of course, the only cruise missiles that the fighter jets, the F-16s, can shoot down are not the hypersonic Kinjal or Tsarkon missiles or the Oreshnik or the Iskander ballistic missiles. Fighter aircraft cannot shoot down those enormously powerful missiles, but they can shoot down subsonic cruise missiles, though I gather that it is far from straightforward a thing to do. They may be subsonic, but they do move very, very fast. And of course, they can also be used to shoot down drones. And that is what they're used for. They are not used, even when they are flown by these veteran pilots, to tangle with the Russian Air Force, which operates mostly east of the Dnieper in eastern Ukraine. It is now universally acknowledged that the F-16s are no match for the far more advanced Russian fighters, the Sukhoi 57s, the Sukhoi 35s, and the MiG 31s. And the result is that we have not yet had, or we have not had, any direct air clash so far between the F-16s and the Russian fighters, because the Ukrainians, or shall we say, the Allies, prefer to keep them out of harm's way. Now, this is a very wasteful way, I suppose, to use fighters, but then it probably is the only way now that cruise missiles and drones can be shot down over Western Ukraine. Because the German government, the German foreign minister, has now admitted that Germany is completely out of surface-to-air missiles. He says that Germany's entire stockpile of Patriot missile interceptors is gone, and all that Germany can supply to Ukraine by way of Patriot air defense missile interceptors is what comes off the production lines in the United States, which Germany buys. This is, by the way, confirmation of the accuracy of that article in Responsible Statecraft by Jennifer Kavanagh that I discussed some time ago, which is that the US military overall is now desperately short of air defense missiles, so much so that this is having a bearing on American military deployments in the Middle East and may be inhibiting an attack on Iran. And one of the reasons why there is this critical shortage of air defense missiles is that the Europeans, or to be more precise, the Germans, buy up all available production as soon as it happens and ship it off to Ukraine, where the Ukrainians try to use these missiles against Russian air incoming missiles and drones. And the Ukrainians use up the air defense missiles, the Patriot missiles, at phenomenal speed. And the production cannot keep up and cannot restore America's critically depleted stockpiles. Now, I say all of this, and perhaps, by the way, we've had another example of the enormous problems Western military industries are facing in ramping up production. I understand that Switzerland has been offered by France and Italy the Aspide air defense system, which, by the way, was also shipped to Ukraine by the French and the Italians, where it appears to have achieved virtually nothing, But anyway, the Swiss have been offered this system, but basically they've been told that if they do agree to buy it, the first of these systems that Switzerland is going to receive will appear in about 2029, because it takes 3 years to build a single one. Well, obviously, we have a critical shortage of air defense systems, which isn't going to be solved anytime soon. In fact, the European military industrial complex is in a terrible mess. I was reading yesterday about a new factory that had been built or supposedly built in Britain to manufacture 155 millimeter shells. The factory has been built, but there has been an indefinite stop, apparently, on it starting production, which suggests that there are acute problems with the factory, which are not explained. And, well, we're left to wonder what they are. Just saying. But anyway, the Ukrainians are out of air defense missiles. The West is out of air defense missiles. And as the conflict continues, this problem will grow. But this use of F-16 fighter jets to try to shoot down drones and missiles, incoming Russian drones and missiles, is also going to create a problem for the West too. I remember reading all about this a few months ago when there was a lot of talk after the supposed Russian drone incursions into Eastern Europe of NATO air forces entering Western Ukraine to shoot down incoming Russian drones and missiles. Now, this has never happened. At least it's never formally happened. What we get instead are old F-16 fighter jets in Ukraine, operated by former NATO pilots. They're trying to do the job themselves. But they're probably, presumably, trying to shoot down these drones and missiles using air-to-air missiles. And I remember reading in the American media that that was a very problematic thing to do, because the sheer number of incoming Russian drones and missiles meant that if the Western powers did that, they would soon start to reduce their stockpile of air-to-air missiles. That it cannot be sustained indefinitely without causing further problems. And of course, in modern aerial warfare, it's become increasingly clear that it is air-to-air missiles, not cannons anymore, that are the essential tool. Well, anyway, I just mentioned all of this. Obviously, I am not an expert in these matters, but we will see how it all plays out. Regardless of this, the war continues, and we see what Kartapolov and people like him are saying. Now, it may be that Kartapolov spoke in order to scare the Ukrainians during the negotiations and to get the Ukrainians to make concessions. But frankly, I don't think so. I think what he said reflects general sentiment in Moscow that the war is indeed going their way, and that when the big offensive comes in the spring, at some point as a result of that offensive, Donbass and Zaporozhye will fall. I come back to what I said at the start of the program. The negotiations in Geneva, the tripartite negotiations have got off to a chaotic start. It may take months, years for these negotiations in the normal course to reach some kind of fruition. I don't believe that Ukraine has those months, all those years, and that's why Kartopolov is talking in the way that he is. And as I said already in my programme yesterday, I believe that is the reason why the Russians now feel that they can upgrade their negotiating team by bringing back Medinsky and Galuzin. Now, another person who may think that too is Donald Trump. Donald Trump said that it's high time that Ukraine sat down and began negotiations and did so seriously. He implied that there is still a deal, but that that deal might not be there for very much longer. And I have to say, based on the realities on the battlefronts, he's almost certainly right. Now, before I conclude this discussion about the Ukraine conflict, I would just quickly say that there's been this discussion between Gordon Hahn and myself about whether the Russians really are hardening their position and whether they really are making a settlement of the conflict in Ukraine conditional on a renegotiation of the security architecture in Europe. Well, the Russians are talking about this all the time now, and the Russian media also are talking about it. I saw a discussion in the Russian media saying that it would take years for the terms of a new security architecture for Europe to be agreed. That's certainly correct. My own personal view is that unless there is a radical change in the political situation in the United States, it is all but inconceivable that the United States will ever agree to a revision of the security architecture in Europe. The Russians may think that is possible. They might have come away from the meeting in Anchorage with the impression that Trump had agreed with them about it. But if so, I think they're going to be disappointed very soon. I don't think the Americans ever seriously made any such commitment, and I don't think any such negotiation is seriously going to take place. I think the same is true about the economic negotiations between Dmitriev and Witkoff. There was a scathing article about a week ago in the heavyweight US magazine Foreign Policy, saying that the entire motivations of the United States in the negotiations over Ukraine and with Russia were commercial, that the Americans, Trump and his inner circle, see Russia as a colossal business opportunity. They want to get this little question of the war in Ukraine out of the way so that they can then cut deals with Russia, which rich people that they already are, are going to make them richer still. And that this is what this is all about. I think there may be some truth to this. I think it might also be going a little too far, just saying. I don't think there's ever going to be, in my lifetime, or at any rate, in recent times, in forthcoming times, any possibility of a real economic trade relationship, a proper trade relationship between the United States and Russia ever being established. The last time anything like that happened was in the early years of Franklin Roosevelt's administration in the 1930s, just say, well, Hoover's as well, perhaps, when the Russians were placing orders for steel and engineering and all kinds of things like that, which they then used in the 1930s in their five-year plans to build up the industrial hubs in places like Magnitogorsk. So I don't myself think this is ever going to happen. I had an email exchange about this. I'm going to disclose this with Eve Smith. We both agreed that there is simply no possibility that the United States is going to lift its economic sanctions on Russia, regardless of how the war in Ukraine ends. And I recall that about 2 years ago, Putin himself, in a speech to the Russian business community, which the Kremlin was careful not to publish, but which was extensively leaked to the Russian media. Anyway, over the course of this speech, Putin himself said that nobody there should ever expect sanctions to be lifted by the West. That was never going to happen. Congress will never agree, certainly not the current Congress, nor any foreseeable one. So, yes, the Russians, the Americans talk to each other. The clock is ticking. Probably Trump, anyway, is going to be absorbed with his adventure, his coming adventure in Iran, and probably the midterms before long. Of course, if the midterms go badly, and all the indications so far are that they will, his ability to conduct diplomacy to end the conflict in Ukraine is going to be hobbled anyway. And everybody knows it. So the clock on the negotiations is ticking. But it suits the Russians, apparently. They come along and to meet the Ukrainians and to meet the Americans. But we see that even as their armies advance, their position hardens. And now we have had an important Russian official and politician for the first time floating the possibility of outright annexation, not just of part of Ukraine, but of the entirety of it. I don't think I've seen this before at any other point in the war. Anyway, I'm going to quickly finish this programme by saying that we've now had more economic data from Russia. There's a large amount of discussion and speculation in the West. There always is, especially in winter. Winter is always a good time for Western commentators to start making apocalyptic claims about the imminent collapse of the Russian economy. Anyway, we've had more economic data coming out of Russia and a decision by the central bank to cut interest rates from 16% to 15.5%. The central bank has now admitted that the decision to cut interest rates was to some extent influenced by incorrect data. They assumed that the VAT increase, which took place in Russia, would increase the rate of inflation in January by 2 points, 2 percentage points. It has turned out to have increased the rate of inflation by what, much less, by around 1.6 percentage points. Inflation in Russia is falling, and by mid-year, it will have reached its 4% target. Nabiullina, the Russian central bank chair, again issued what struck me as a fairly confident report. This is before the latest inflation numbers actually came out. But anyway, she said that inflation was indeed coming down, that the overall situation of the economy was stable, that growth was likely to return, or not return, but the economy was going to accelerate again fairly soon, once interest rates came down further. And I got the impression that she's looking for a long-term interest rate in Russia of around 8% against an underlying rate of inflation of around 4%, or significantly less than now. She also said that the results of the Russian investment boom that took place over the previous 3 years, all of the new plant and machinery and all of that, which had been planned and built over the course of that investment boom, that all of that is now going to come on stream, probably fairly soon, and that will also depress the inflation numbers and open the way for further growth. And on the question of oil prices and the oil trade, she said, yes, oil prices have been low. Yes, there have been attempts to sanction Russia's oil trade. But frankly, she didn't seem to be too bothered. And she also said that, for the moment at least, even as oil exports have fallen, other exports have increased. And though the increase has not been enough to offset the fall in oil exports, overall Russia continues to have a healthy trade position. I was recently reading reports about how Nabiullina supposedly has told Putin that the war must be ended this year, or the Russian economy will collapse, or at least fall into serious recession. Well, I have to say, there is not a hint of this in her latest report. I am unable to see any sign of any of this. I suspect that this is all speculation and rumours conjured up by those who not only want the sanctions to continue, but who want the sanctions to be increased, and I myself don't take it seriously. Meanwhile, Patrushev, the Putin's aide, the man who is in charge of Russia's shipping industry, but also who has overall supervision of Russia's shipbuilding program, has issued further warnings that the Russians will defend with their navy their merchant ships, and that there are discussions amongst the BRICS, in other words, between China and Russia, about providing escorts for merchant ships that conduct trade, not just between these countries, but on behalf of the BRICS states. So anyway, it looks to me as if the situation is stable. I intend to return to what Patrushev said in a further program, but this is where I'm going to finish this program today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, as well as Substack. Don't forget also that you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. And of course, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.